This is what the voices were saying.
Would you mind explaining that again?
Well, if you return anything except a trump, South will be able to get his two roughs, losing only one turtle, one elephant, and one major arcana. Then... That's two flower, hissed Rincewind. I'd know that voice anywhere.
Just a minute. Pestilence is South?
Oh, come on, Mort. He explained that. What if famine had played a trump return?
It was a breathy, wet voice, practically contagious all by itself.
Ah, then you'd only be able to rough one turtle instead of two, said Two Flower, enthusiastically. But if war had chosen a trump lead originally, then the contract would have gone two down. Exactly.
I didn't quite follow that. Tell me about psychic bids again. I thought I was getting the hang of that.
It was a heavy, hollow voice, like two large lumps of lead smashing together.
That's when you make a bid primarily to deceive your opponents, but of course it might cause problems for your partner.
Two Flower's voice rambled on in its enthusiastic way. Rincewind looked blankly at Usabel as words like rebiddable suit, double finesse, and grand slam floated through the velvet.
Do you understand any of that? She asked.
Not a word, he said.
It sounds awfully complicated.
On the other side of the door, the heavy voice said,
Did you say humans play this for fun?
Some of them get to be very good at it, yes. I'm only an amateur, I'm afraid.
But they only live 80 or 90 years.
You should know, Mort,
said a voice that Rincewind hadn't heard before, and certainly never wanted to hear again, especially after dark.
It's certainly very intriguing.
Deal again, and let's see if I've got the hang of it.
Do you think perhaps we should go in?
Said Usabel. A voice behind the door said,
I bid the Knave of Terrapins.
No, sorry, I'm sure you're wrong. Let's have a look at your hand. Usabel pushed the door open. It was, in fact, a rather pleasant study, perhaps a little on the somber side, possibly created on a bad day by an interior designer who had a headache and a craving for putting large hourglasses on every flat surface, and also a lot of large, fat, yellow, and extremely runny candles he wanted to get rid of. The Death of the Disc was a traditionalist, who prided himself on his personal service and spent most of the time being depressed because this was not appreciated. He would point out that no one feared death itself, just pain and separation and oblivion, and that it was quite unreasonable to take against someone just because he had empty eye sockets and a quiet pride in his work. He still used a scythe, he'd point out, while the deaths of other worlds had long ago invested in combine harvesters. Death sat at one side of a black baize table in the centre of the room, arguing with famine, war, and pestilence. Two Flower was the only one to look up and notice Rincewind.
"Hey, how did you get here?"
he said.
"Well, some say the Creator took a handful of... Oh, I see. Well, it's hard to explain, but I...
Have you got the luggage?"
The wooden box pushed past Rincewind and settled down in front of its owner, who opened its lid and rummaged around inside until he came up with a small leather-bound book, which he handed to War, who was hammering the table with a mailed fist.
"It's Nose Hinger on the Laws of Contract," he said. "It's quite good. There's a lot in it about double finessing and how to—"
Death snatched the book with a bony hand and flipped through the pages, quite oblivious to the presence of the two men.
"Right. Pestilence, open another pack of cards. I'm going to get to the bottom of this if it kills me. Figuratively speaking, of course."
Rincewind grabbed Two Flower and pulled him out of the room. As they jogged down the corridor with the luggage galloping behind them, he said,
"What was all that about?"
"Well, they've got lots of time, and I thought they might enjoy it," panted Two Flower. "What, playing with cards?"
"It's a special kind of playing," said Two Flower. "It's called..." He hesitated. Language wasn't his strong point.
"In your language, it's called a thing you put across a river, for example," he concluded. "I think."
"Aqueduct?" hazarded Rincewind.
"Fishing line?" Weir? Dam?
Yes, possibly. They reached the hallway where the big clock still shaved the seconds off the lives of the world.
And how long do you think that'll keep them occupied?
Twoflower paused.
I'm not sure, he said thoughtfully. Probably until the last trump.
What an amazing clock!
Don't try to buy it, Rincewind advised. I don't think they'd appreciate it around here.
Where is here, exactly? Said Twoflower, beckoning the luggage and opening its lid.
Rincewind looked around. The hall was dark and deserted, its tall narrow windows walled with ice. He looked down. There was the faint blue line stretching away from his ankle. Now he could see that Twoflower had one too.
We're sort of informally dead, he said. It was the best he could manage.
Oh,
Twoflower continued to rummage.
Doesn't that worry you?
Well, things tend to work out in the end, don't you think? Anyway, I'm a firm believer in reincarnation. What would you like to come back as?
I don't want to go, said Rincewind firmly. Come on, let's get out of... Oh, no, not that.
Twoflower had produced a box from the depths of the luggage. It was large and black and had a handle on one side and a little round window in front and a strap so that Twoflower could put it round his neck, which he did. There was a time when Rincewind had quite liked the iconoscope. He believed, against all experience, that the world was fundamentally understandable and that if he could only equip himself with the right mental toolbox, he could take the back off and see how it worked. He was, of course, dead wrong. The iconoscope didn't take pictures by letting light fall onto specially treated paper, as he had surmised, but by the far simpler method of imprisoning a small demon with a good eye for colour and a speedy hand with a paintbrush. He had been very upset to find that out.
"You haven't got time to take pictures," he hissed.
"It won't take long," said Twoflower firmly, and rapped on the side of the box. A tiny door flew open, and the imp poked his head out.
"Bloody hell," it said. "Where are we?"
"It doesn't matter," said Twoflower. "The clock first, I think."
The demon squinted.
"Poor light," he said. 3 bloody years at F8, if you ask me."
He slammed the door shut. A second later, there was the tiny scraping noise of his stool being dragged up to his easel. Rincewind gritted his teeth.
"You don't need to take pictures. You can just remember it," he shouted.
"It's not the same," said Twoflower calmly.
"It's better. It's more real."
"It isn't really. In years to come, when I'm sitting by the fire..."
"You'll be sitting by the fire forever if we don't get out of here."
"Oh, I do hope you're not going."
They both turned. Usabel was standing in the archway, smiling faintly. She held a scythe in one hand, a scythe with a blade of proverbial sharpness. Rincewind tried not to look down at his blue lifeline. A girl holding a scythe shouldn't smile in that unpleasant, knowing and slightly deranged way.
"Daddy seems a little preoccupied at the moment, but I'm sure he wouldn't dream of letting you go off just like that," she added. "Besides, I'd have no one to talk to."
"Who's this?" said Twoflower. "She sort of lives here," mumbled Rincewind. "She's a sort of girl," he added.
He grabbed Twoflower's shoulder and tried to shuffle imperceptibly towards the door into the dark, cold garden. It didn't work, largely because Twoflower wasn't the sort of person who went in for nuances of expression and somehow never assumed that anything bad might apply to him.
"Charmed, I'm sure," he said. "Very nice place you have here. Interesting Baroque effect with the bones and skulls."
Isabel smiled. Rincewind thought, if death ever does hand over the family business, she'll be better at it than he is. She's bonkers.
"Yes, but we must be going," he said.
"I really won't hear of it," she said. "You must stay and tell me all about yourselves. There's plenty of time, and it's so boring here."
She darted sideways and swung the scythe at the shining threads. It screamed through the air like a neutered tomcat and stopped sharply. There was the creak of wood. The luggage had snapped its lid shut on the blade. Twoflower looked up at Rincewind in astonishment, and the wizard, with great deliberation and a certain amount of satisfaction, hit him smartly on the chin. As the little man fell backwards, Rincewind caught him, threw him over a shoulder, and ran. Branches whipped at him in the starlit garden, and small, furry, and probably horrible things scampered away as he pounded desperately along the faint lifeline that shone eerily on the freezing grass. From the building behind him came a shrill scream of disappointment and rage. He cannoned off a tree and sped on. Somewhere there was a path, he remembered. But in this maze of silver light and shadows, tinted now with red, as the terrible new star made its presence felt even in the netherworld, nothing looked right. Anyway, the lifeline appeared to be going in quite the wrong direction. There was the sound of feet behind him. Rincewind wheezed with effort. It sounded like the luggage, and at the moment he didn't want to meet the luggage because it might have got the wrong idea about him hitting its master, and generally the luggage bit people it didn't like. Rincewind had never had the nerve to ask where it was they actually went when the heavy lid slammed shut on them, but they certainly weren't there when it opened again. In fact, he needn't have worried. The luggage overtook him easily, its little legs a blur of movement. It seemed to Rincewind to be concentrating very heavily on running, as if it had some inkling of what was coming up behind it and didn't like the idea at all. "Don't look back," he remembered. "The view probably isn't very nice." The luggage crashed through a bush and vanished. A moment later, Rincewind saw why. It had careened over the edge of the outcrop and was dropping towards the great hole underneath, which he could now see was faintly red-lit at the bottom. Stretching from Rincewind, out over the edge of the rocks and down into the hole, were two shimmering blue lines. He paused uncertainly, although that isn't precisely true because he was totally certain of several things. For example, that he didn't want to jump, and that he certainly didn't want to face whatever it was coming up behind him, and that in the spirit world, Two Flower was quite heavy, and that there were worse things than being dead. "Name two," he muttered, and jumped. A few seconds later, the horsemen arrived and didn't stop when they reached the edge of the rock, but simply rode into the air and reined their horses over nothingness. Death looked down.
"That always annoys me. I might as well install a revolving door."
"I wonder what they wanted," said Pestilence.
"Search me," said War. "Nice game, though."
"Right," agreed Famine. "Compelling, I thought."
"We've got time for another fondle."
Rubber, corrected War.
"Rubber what?"
You call them rubbers," said War.
Right, rubbers."
He looked up at the new star, puzzled as to what it might mean.
"I think we've got time,"
he repeated, a trifle uncertainly. Mention has already been made of an attempt to inject a little honesty into reporting on the disc, and how poets and bards were banned on pain of, well, pain, from going on about babbling brooks and rosy-fingered dawn, and could only say, for example, that a face had launched 1,000 ships if they were able to produce certified dockyard accounts. And therefore, out of a passing respect for this tradition, it will not be said of Rincewind and Two Flower that they became an ice-blue sine wave arcing through the dark dimensions, or that there was a sound like the twanging of a monstrous tusk, or that their lives passed in front of their eyes. Rincewind had in any case seen his past life flash in front of his eyes so many times that he could sleep through the boring bits, or that the universe dropped on them like a large jelly. It will be said, because experiment has proved it to be true, that there was a noise like a wooden ruler being struck heavily with a C-sharp tuning fork, possibly B-flat, and a sudden sensation of absolute stillness. This was because they were absolutely still, and it was absolutely dark. It occurred to Rincewind that something had gone wrong. Then he saw the faint blue tracery in front of him. He was inside the octavo again. He wondered what would happen if anyone opened the book. Would he and Two Flower appear, like a colour plate? Probably not, he decided. The octavo they were in was something a bit different from the mere book chained to its lectern deep in Unseen University, which was merely a three-dimensional representation of a multidimensional reality, and... Hold on, he thought. I don't like this. Who's thinking for me?
Rincewind,
said a voice like the rustle of old pages.
Who, me?
Of course you daft sod.
A flicker of defiance flared very briefly in Rincewind's battered heart.
Have you managed to recall how the universe started yet? He said nastily.
The clearing of the throat, wasn't it? Or the drawing of the breath? Or the scratching of the head and trying to remember it? It was on the tip of the tongue? Another voice, dry as tinder, hissed.
You would do well to remember where you are.
It should be impossible to hiss a sentence with no sibilance in it, but the voice made a very good attempt. Remember where I am? Remember where I am? Shouted Rincewind. Of course I remember where I am. I'm inside a bloody book talking to a load of voices I can't see. Why do you think I'm screaming?
I expect you're wondering why we brought you here again,
said a voice by his ear. No.
No?
What did he say?
Said another disembodied voice.
He said no.
He really said no?
Yes.
Oh. Why?
This sort of thing happens to me all the time, said Rincewind. One minute I'm falling off the world, then I'm inside a book, then I'm on a flying rock, then I'm watching Death learn how to play Weir or Damn or whatever it was. And why should I wonder about anything?
Well, we imagine you will be wondering why we don't want anyone to say us,
said the first voice, aware that it was losing the initiative. Rincewind hesitated. The thought had crossed his mind, only very fast and looking nervously from side to side in case it got knocked over. Why should anyone want to say you?
It's the star,
said the spell.
The red star. Wizards are already looking for you. When they find you, they want to say all 8 spells together to change the future. They think the disk is going to collide with the star.
Rincewind thought about this. Is it?
Not exactly, but what's that?
Rincewind looked down. The luggage padded out of the darkness. There was a long sliver of scythe blade in its lid. Oh, it's just the luggage, he said.
But we didn't summon it here.
No one summons it anywhere, said Rincewind. It just turns up. Don't worry about it.
Oh, what were we talking about?
This red star thing.
Oh, right. It's very important that you...
Hello? Hello? Anyone out there?
It was a small and squeaky voice, and came from the picture box, still slung around Two Flowers' inert neck. The picture imp opened his hatch and squinted up at Rincewind.
Where's this, Squire?
It said. I'm not sure.
We still dead?
Maybe.
Well, let's hope we go somewhere where we don't need too much black, because I've run out.
The hatch slammed shut. Rincewind had a fleeting vision of Two Flower handing around his pictures and saying things like, This is me being tormented by a million demons, and this is me with that funny couple we met on the freezing slopes of the underworld. Rincewind wasn't certain about what happened to you after you really died. The authorities were a little unclear on the subject. A swarthy sailor from the Rimwood lands had said that he was confident of going to paradise, where there was sherbet and hoodris. Rincewind wasn't certain what a hoodri was, but after some thought he came to the conclusion that it was a little licorice tube for sucking up the sherbet. Anyway, sherbet made him sneeze.
Now that the interruption is over,
said a dry voice firmly,
perhaps we can get on. It is most important that you don't let the wizards take the spell from you. Terrible things will happen if all 8 spells are said too soon.
I just want to be left in peace, said Rincewind.
Good, good. We knew we could trust you from the day you first opened the octavo.
Rincewind hesitated. Hang on a minute, he said. You want me to run around keeping the wizards from getting all the spells together?
Exactly.
That's why one of you got into my head?
Precisely.
You totally ruined my life, you know that? Said Rincewind hotly. I could have really made it as a wizard if you hadn't decided to use me as a sort of portable spell book.
I can't remember any other spells. They're too frightened to stay in the same head as you.
We're sorry.
I just want to go home. I want to go back to where...
A trace of moisture appeared in Rincewind's eye.
To where there's cobbles under your feet, and some of the beer isn't too bad, and you can get quite a good piece of fried fish of an evening, with maybe a couple of big green gherkins, and even an eel pie and a dish of whelks, and there's always a warm stable somewhere to sleep in. And in the morning you're always in the same place as you were the night before, and there wasn't all this weather all over the place. I mean, I don't mind about the magic. I'm probably not, you know, the right sort of material for a wizard, but I just want to go home.
But you must.
One of the spells began, but it was too late. Homesickness, the little elastic band in the subconscious that can wind up a salmon and propel it 3,000 miles through strange seas, or send a million lemmings running joyfully back to an ancestral homeland, which, owing to a slight kink in the continental drift, isn't there any more. Homesickness rose up inside Rincewind like a late-night prawn biryani, flowed along the tenuous thread linking his tortured soul to his body, dug its heels in, and tugged. The spells were alone inside their octavo, alone at any rate apart from the luggage. They looked at it, not with eyes, but with consciousness as old as the Discworld itself.
"And you can bugger off too," they said.
Bad. Rincewind knew it was himself speaking. He recognised the voice. For a moment he was looking out through his eyes, not in any normal way, but as a spy might peer through the cut-out eyes of a picture. Then he was back.
"You okay, Rincewind?"
said Cohen.
"You looked a bit gone there."
"You did look a bit white," agreed Bethan, "like someone had walked over your grave."
Yes, it was probably me," he said.
He held up his fingers and counted them. There appeared to be the normal amount.
"Have I moved at all?" he said.
"You just looked at the fires as if you'd seen a ghost," said Bethan.
There was a groan behind them. Twoflower was sitting up holding his head in his hands. His eyes focused on them. His lips moved soundlessly.
"That was a really strange dream," he said. "What's this place? Why am I here?"
"Well," said Cohen, "some say the creator of the universe took a handful of clay and..."
"No, I mean here," said Twoflower. "Is that you, Rincewind?"
"Yes," said Rincewind, giving it the benefit of the doubt.
"There was this... a clock that... And these people who..."
said Twoflower. He shook his head.
"Why does everything smell of horses?"
"You've been ill," said Rincewind, "hallucinating."
"Yes, I suppose I was."
Twoflower looked down at his chest.
"But in that case, why have I..."
Rincewind jumped to his feet. "Sorry, very close in here. Got to have a breath of fresh air," he said. He removed the picture box's strap from Twoflower's neck and dashed for the tent flap.
"I didn't notice that when he came in," said Bethan.
Cohen shrugged. Rincewind managed to get a few yards from the yurt before the ratchet of the picture box began to click. Very slowly, the box extruded the last picture that the imp had taken. Rincewind snatched it. What it showed would have been quite horrible even in broad daylight. By freezing starlight, tinted red with the fires of the evil new star, it was a lot worse.
"No," said Rincewind softly. "No, it wasn't like that. There was a house, and this girl, and..."
"You see what you see, and I paint what I see,"
said the imp from its hatch.
"What I see is real. I was bred for it. I only see what's really there."
A dark shape crunched over the snow crust towards Rincewind. It was the luggage. Rincewind, who normally hated and distrusted it, suddenly felt it was the most refreshingly normal thing he had ever seen.
"I see you made it then," said Rincewind.
The luggage rattled its lid. "Okay, but what did you see?" said Rincewind. "Did you look behind?" The luggage said nothing. For a moment they were silent, like two warriors who have fled the field of carnage and have paused for a return of breath and sanity. Then Rincewind said, "Come on, there's a fire inside." He reached out to pat the luggage's lid. It snapped irritably at him, nearly catching his fingers. Life was back to normal again.